Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. View. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's a show where we don't take calls. No, we do not. We don't tolerate sponsors either. And now we're a month off the Drudge Report. Not a single visit in a month now. I wonder if I'm behind on anything. Have I missed anything? I don't think so. I don't feel like I have. Anyway, I gave a quote a few weeks back. And I wasn't sure who it was from. And so I did the research and I found out. And I would like to give the whole quote because, as you know, we are at war here in America against the invisible enemy. The invisible enemy. That was almost Trump, right? The invisible enemy. Still not very good.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can't quite... No, that's okay. No, you don't have to listen. It's... No. Anyway, I want to give the whole quote because this is a time of war, and allegedly, and I want to, I just want to give credit where credit is due. And so here is the entire quote in which Thomas Hobbes, from his publication Leviathan from 1660, wrote about a time of war. He said, "Whatsoever therefore is consequent to a time of war, where every man is enemy to every man, the same consequent to the time wherein men live without other security than what their own strength and their own innovation shall furnish them withal. In such condition, there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, no use of the commodities that may be imported by sea. No commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things, such as require much force. No knowledge in the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society. And which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death. And the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Unquote. That was Thomas Hobbes from Leviathan, published in 1660. Hobbes was over 70 years old when he wrote Leviathan. And I am ordering up a copy because that's good writing and I always appreciate good writing. So we will be ordering up a copy to be delivered here at the McBurney compound. Speaking of deliveries, I just spoke with a friendly Amazon delivery man in his Amazon delivery van. And he and I actually got within, 16 inches of each other talking over the fence as he handed me a package and our hands actually touched. He didn't have a mask on. I didn't have a mask on. Hopefully we both survive. But the good news is that the bathroom tissue was delivered to the McBurney compound. So that's a sure sign that the end of all of this panic and chaos is at hand. Surely that is a sign. That's right. Here at the McBurney compound, there has been no bathroom tissue purchased in over 4 months, except for the token two-pack that I purchased at the store at the height of the panic when I bought those little ghetto toilet paper rolls for 99 cents for four rolls. Bought two of them just as a token of the... It'll be, it'll be memorabilia someday. We're sending them down to the bronzer to be bronzed as we speak. Anyway, most great literary achievements are achieved by relatively young men. It's actually surprising if you go back through history. Many great scientific achievements, literary achievements, and artistic achievements were achieved by relatively young men. But Hobbes had some longevity to him, and so I have a desire now to read Leviathan, and I shall do so. But first, let's get to the news of the day, because I do want to help focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And to do that, we go to thenationalfile.com, where it is being reported that Yusuf Ali, a British citizen, you may remember this story. Yusuf Ali, he threw an 18-year-old girl off a 40-foot balcony and then stabbed two other people at a party. Well, he's been tried, and he was not convicted of attempted murder. He was not convicted of attempted murder. This is in England. I don't know why he was not convicted of attempted murder, but he was not. And he has been sentenced to 14 years in prison. He threw an 18-year-old girl off a 40-foot balcony and stabbed two other people at a party. And he's been sentenced to 14 years. That's the state of justice in the world today. It is injustice. And what did Hobbes say? Hobbes said that there will be no place for industry because the fruit thereof is uncertain. And if judicial outcomes like this are allowed to continue, it's not long before we're all living in a Clockwork Orange and Mad Max and all of that. And there will be no place for industry because the fruit thereof shall be uncertain because of the rampant crime that's everywhere. We go from the other side of the pond back here to Madison, Wisconsin, where a Milwaukee man shot and killed five of his family members this past week before calling police and saying, quote, "I just massacred my whole family," quote. When police arrived, they found the killer on the front step of the house, and they asked the murderer if he had heard any shots, and the killer responded, "Yeah, I didn't hear them, I did them," at which point he was arrested. The victims were aged 14, 16, 17, 19, and 41. And the killer, how old was the killer? The killer was 43. So this, it looks like this man killed his wife and four of his children. An infant was found alive in the house. Just unbelievably horrible, horrific, terrible story that barely made page five of the newspaper there in Madison. This killer who murdered his entire family, it appears, pleaded guilty in 2007 to felony battering, bail jumping, intimidation of a witness. He was sentenced to 4.5 years. He was also prohibited from possessing firearms. 5 years later, in 2012, he pleaded guilty to misdemeanor battery, domestic abuse. He was sentenced to 18 months and was again prohibited from possessing firearms. In 2017, he pleaded guilty to misdemeanor disorderly conduct and spent a month in jail, got out on work release every day. And then he was also convicted in 2002 of misdemeanor battery, sentenced to probation, domestic abuse counseling, and prohibited from possessing firearms. And so that's from the Domestic Tranquility File. Now from there we go to the Hard Religion File. That's right, the Hard Religion File. Radio Free Asia is reporting that Pastor Zhao, the founder of Bethel Church, was arrested on April 2nd after being criminally detained since March 14th for inciting subversion of state power. Pastor Zhao's whereabouts are currently unknown. So he has been disappeared since March 14th. Since right around the time the world began to lock itself down, Pastor Zhao was locked down literally by the Chinese government. Authorities accused him of using VPN software to avoid the Great Chinese Firewall and sharing political content, including what happened in Wuhan, the epicenter of the current pandemic. Before, his wife says, before her husband was arrested, He was asked multiple times to join the Three Self Patriotic Movement. That's the state-sponsored Protestant church, church in quotation marks, in China. And Pastor Zhao refused to join the state-sanctioned church. And so now he's been disappeared, he's been arrested, he'll be tried, and no doubt he'll be imprisoned. He'll be actually locked down for many, many years, unless things change dramatically in China, which we're still hoping for. Although it looks less and less likely that this will have the impact on the Chinese Communist Party that we had hoped for here at the Weekly Worldview. But we still pray for God to bless the righteous and destroy the wicked every day. And so hopefully that day is coming. In its annual report last year, by the way, the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom called China the world's foremost violator of human rights and religious freedom. And this is the country upon whom we rely for almost everything, including credit. Interesting. Hopefully that's going to change. All right. Are we having any fun yet? We're really not having any fun yet. And I'm not sure we're going to get to any fun anytime soon, but I'll do my best. I go now to New York City. We're in the middle of the lockdown. Murders in New York City have jumped about 55% compared to the same time last year. Between April 13th and 19th in New York, murders increased 100% compared to the same week from last year. Year-to-date murders are up almost 6%. Likewise, Grand Theft Auto increased more than 53%. And a Grand Theft Auto, by the way, is a no-bail situation in New York. Now, you can commit Grand Theft Auto and be released from jail before your trial with no bail. Over the last week, Grand Theft Auto crimes across the city jumped over 50%. They're up more than 62% overall since the year before. The largest spike in crime year to date for any major category. And burglaries in New York. During the lockdown, burglaries are up by 25%. So what's up with the crime wave in New York? Well, I think it might be due to the wholesale release of criminals. Not only does the wholesale release of criminals in New York allow those actual criminals to commit crimes, but it puts in the minds of all the other criminals that it's pretty much a free-for-all out there. And that's what's happening, I believe, is it's a free-for-all in New York. And everybody's locked down and the streets are empty and the criminally minded feel like they can get away with stuff. That's what it is. And then there are the actual criminals who are actually doing the crimes. There was one fellow who was awaiting trial for some sort of gross sex crime. I threw the story out because it was too gross. Anyway, he was awaiting trial for rape, as a matter of fact. He was released, and then he did something so disgusting and perverted that they ended up rearresting him within a week or so. So there's the actual criminals, and then there's the whole criminal mindset that's being encouraged, and then there's the whole no bail situation, which again just improves the appeal or increases the appeal of criminal activity to people who already have a bent toward criminal activity. Hence, you have a fairly dramatic rise in criminal activity in a city that is allegedly locked down. Do I want to say, I don't want to talk about that right now. You know what I want to talk about? I want to talk about Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry, about 245 years ago, made a speech before the Virginia Assembly to a group of people who were hesitant about whether or not Americans should declare their independence and challenge the Empire of Great Britain for our liberty. The American independence movement was not a popular movement. It was a vocal minority of very brave men. And on March 23rd, yeah, most people didn't want to. No, they wanted to be comfortable and they were okay with things the way they were. But on March 23rd, 1775, Patrick Henry stood up and gave the famous speech that ended with that famous line, "Give me liberty or give me death." And just a short 245 years later, after America was birthed in that spirit of "give me liberty or give me death," she is perishing in the spirit of "take my liberty for fear of death." And you are one with the cause, and a reason to be. You were a fighter for peace on this earth, and you were never afraid. You put your life on the line, and you were always there. Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's good to be with everybody, and so I don't want to get hung up on this whole end of America theme, although I'm not sure how we get this to stop. I'm not sure how we get this to stop and how we get this all back, but we'll talk about that later. What I want to talk about is the Bird Whisperer's latest adventures in Parakeet Land. See, now the Bird Whisperer has developed an acute fondness for parakeets, and now she has, how many parakeets does she have? She has 8 parakeets in one giant cage right now. And so the Bird Whisperer got a little too loose earlier, well, last week, got a little too loose with the parakeets, and one of the parakeets escaped from the cage outside the house out into the wild. The parakeet flew. And so I was down working on the stairway to the goat pen, and I wasn't aware of the situation until I came back up the hill to the house, and I could see on the face of the Bird Whisperer that desperate look. It's looking heavenward and whistling and calling, and I asked her what was going on. She told me the situation, that the parakeet, apparently the Bird Whisperer hadn't clipped the parakeet wings quite enough, and the parakeet escaped out into the wild. And so this went on from late morning until nightfall, and then it became apparent that the parakeet was not coming home. Even though we could hear the parakeet from time to time, the parakeet did not come home that night. And then the following day, late in the afternoon, after the Bird Whisperer spent the whole day walking around with her phone with a parakeet chirp on it, and at one point during the day, we saw the parakeet. The parakeet flew from one tree to another so high that it looked like a tiny little bug, little shiny green bug. And I looked at that parakeet, and I thought, well, that parakeet's never coming back. Why would that parakeet ever come back? It's out in the wild. And so the Bird Whisperer walked around and whistled and had the phone with the chirp on it. And I'm not sure exactly of all the details of how the reunion occurred, but she got the parakeet back. The parakeet eventually came home, allowed the Bird Whisperer to grasp the parakeet and put the parakeet back in the cage. And I've just never heard of anything like that before. That's all. That's a fairly unique situation, and... Everyone. Oh, and then, yeah, she did clip the wings. The bird looks almost freakish now with like half the wings. Anyway, that parakeet is not going to fly the coop again. And what's that now?
Just for a while.
And we told the bird whisperer to just don't get so loose with the birds. All right. Meanwhile, okay, we've already done the crime wave in New York. Let's go to Dr. Anthony Falty. Dr. Anthony Falty, who is, what is he? He's the head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, he is. And he has been for a long time. And apparently last year, Dr. Falty and his organization, the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, funded scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology for work on gain-of-function research. Gain-of-function research, I said, at the aforementioned Wuhan Institute of Virology. Many scientists have criticized gain-of-function research, which involves manipulating viruses in the lab to explore their potential for infecting humans, because it creates a risk of starting a pandemic from accidental release. And it seems like that's what's happened here, is that the current novel coronavirus escaped from this exact institute, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, whom Dr. Fauci gave several millions of dollars via the National Institutes of Health, which the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases is a part. So Dr. Falty, is this like the fireman who starts the fire? No, I don't think it's that. I'm sure that this wasn't intentional. This is just incidental to the fact that we're in bed with the Chinese. We rely on the Chinese for just about anything, just about everything. And it's not surprising that we end up funding the Chinese institute that ends up releasing the bug that kills all these people and causes this widespread hysteria and panic. It's to be expected, I suppose. It's just to be expected. So I guess that's all I've got on. He's been asked about it, I guess. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, he was asked about it. Doc, this is from Newsweek. I didn't know Newsweek was even still around. Look at that. Huh. Anyway, Dr. Fauci has not responded to Newsweek's request for a comment on the fact that he was involved in funding the lab from which he could at least just comment on the irony of it. Come on, Doc. Can't you at least see the irony here? I mean, it's not ha-ha funny, but, you know. All right. Meanwhile, you know, from the dim new world file, Washington. Boy, there's a Freudian slip. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio revealed last Sunday that his wife, Charlene, will be the co-chair of a task force on racial inclusion and equity as the city plans its reopening. So that's top of mind for Bill de Blasio, is giving his wife a no-show job. I wonder if there's any money involved here. Does the chairman, the co-chair of the task force on racial inclusion and equity, get any kind of salary? And are there any other dim-witted nephews or relatives of Bill de Blasio that will be populating this task force on racial inclusion and equity? That's what's top of de Blasio's mind. Racial inclusion and equity. And nobody even knows what that means. It really has no hard meaning. You can just infuse that with whatever makes you feel good. De Blasio says, the reason we need my wife on this task force is because the economic and racial disparities have now been made clear by this crisis. We knew about them before, but now a powerful and painful exclamation point has been put on them by this crisis. I have no idea what he's talking about. Is he implying that the virus itself is racist? So I have read that certain races have receptors in their lungs or have a prevalence towards certain receptors in their lungs that make them more, vulnerable to this particular type of virus. But I don't know if you could say that's racist. I think Bill de Blasio, he thinks and thought that everything is always racist, although he actually doesn't care about it. It's been a device that he uses successfully, and so he's going to use that device again in the face of this pandemic, and his wife gets a gig at the Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, a no-show job for dim-witted relatives of the mayor and the city council and any of the other aldermen who may have dim-witted relatives who need a place to collect a meager government salary. Let's see. City lawmakers on both sides of the aisle were scratching their heads over the appointment. Really? Why would you be scratching your heads over that? It seems perfectly normal to me. Well, they were scratching their heads because Charlene, who has a different last name than de Blasio, her last name is McCray. De Blasio's is de Blasio. So she's one of these feminists who doesn't take the surname of her supine, slope-shouldered, lily-livered, weenie husband. That's it. Anyway, apparently she was in charge of the Thrive New York City initiative. That's her last no-show job. And apparently there's a whole bunch of money that's either missing or been misappropriated. There's all kinds of questions about it. I'm sorry, did I say millions? I meant billions. There are billions of dollars. The people in New York have called Ms. de Blasio's, forgive me, Ms. McCray, I'm going to go with the traditional. I'm going to act as if Bill de Blasio is a real man, and I'm going to give you his last name. Apparently, Ms. de Blasio's signature Thrive program is being criticized in New York as a billion-dollar money pit with a dubious record of results. Well, then it sounds like she's perfect for this gig. That sounds like the perfect person to run the Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, because it will be a money pit, and the results are bound to be dubious. And since she has since she has experience in that area already, why, that hire makes perfect sense then. Okay, all right. Meanwhile, in the proof of life file, I said the proof of life. That's right. America's not dead yet. Not quite. Let's see here. Statewide random antibody tests in the state of New York has expanded to 7,500 people and now reveals a better picture of the extent of the coronavirus spread in New York. This is from April 27th. About 25% of people in New York City have antibodies for COVID-19. About 15% statewide tested positive for antibodies. Remember, it was 14. Now this is a bigger study. Now it's closer to it's up 1% across the state and up significantly in New York City, about 25% positive, which means the this is proof, by the way. This isn't speculation. This isn't a right-wing shill for Donald Trump releasing this data. This is actual data, and this is proof that this virus is not nearly as deadly as we have been led to believe. And I had to go back and check the archives, but it seems to me that since before the lockdown even started, that was becoming obvious because of data that was coming out of China. And I'm not talking about data from the Chinese Communist Party. By the end of February and early March, we had doctors and hospitals in the United States in touch with actual doctors on the ground in China, talking to each other and exchanging data on infection rates and death rates. And it was already becoming apparent that this thing was not nearly as virulent as, you know, who was the one who decided that we could count just the known cases and then compare that to the death rate and then make everyone believe that that was the death rate? Who did that? How were they allowed to get away with that? Is that the way it's been done before? Because I know they've tried to scare us. Seems like every few years there's some bug that they try to scare me with. And so I've really come to something of a boy cried wolf situation to where I tend to doubt them. That's my default position, is I tend to doubt that the criminally insane people ruling us, who have been trying to scare me for the last 30 years over various viruses and bugs and bacterias, I just have a tendency to look at them like the boy crying wolf, and I tend not to believe them. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, and I don't know when we started with that, because obviously I haven't followed these as closely as I should have, because I have this tendency not to pay attention. But it seems to me, just going by the confirmed cases and the people who died, that doesn't seem like valid data to me. So I just didn't believe it. That's all. I didn't believe it. Because you really have to take into account the whole population. And if you take into account the whole population, I mean, all right, but let me finish with this. So now that we know for a fact that at least 25% of all the residents in New York City have this virus, it's just absolute proof that this thing is not going to collapse our medical systems. It's not going to happen. The peak has passed. We need to get on with it. And we need to get on with it without dirty rags on our faces or dirty rubber gloves or social distancing or lockdowns or any of it. It's all counterproductive at this point. All right, now, but before I go on, I do want to point out, I want to talk about the politics of this for a moment. And I know I was talking with a friend of mine on the phone, and we were discussing the politics of this whole situation, and he stopped in mid-conversation. He said, oh, and by the way, I just want to let you know, I don't want to downplay the people who've died, and I don't want to say that all lives... And I said, just stop. I said, stop. You don't have to say that. You don't have to tell me that you don't appreciate people dying and you care about people's lives. That should go without saying. We're civilized people. But we're living in a political environment now where if you try to talk about the politics of this without stopping to acknowledge that people have gotten sick and died from this, we seem to have a fear that we'll be perceived as mean, when the default position of everyone should be that we generally don't want people to die. That should be our default assumption about our fellow civilized human beings, but that's gotten lost in all of this, and it's very frustrating to me. So I told him, stop. You don't have to tell me that you appreciate people living and not dying. Let's just say that goes without saying between us. And then we continued the conversation. But back to the politics. I believe that we are about to witness, I mean, we are witnessing it, but we are about to witness one of the most vicious political plays in human history. And of course, as most viciousness does, this particular viciousness comes from the left, from the media first, and then their politicians second, and then the leftist citizens third. And so let me describe what's happened and what I believe is about to happen as we go into the election season here. We're still going to go into the election season, despite the fact that the world has ended for all intents and purposes, or at least it's paused. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's been broken. The world's been broken. So first, you remember, and I've already covered this, You know, the leftists, they take advantage of fear and uncertainty and they create a panic. That's what the media did. They lost their impeachment story. They saw this virus. They saw the uncertainty. They saw the fact that China lied. They took advantage of the fear and the uncertainty. They created a panic. Then they convinced the cowardly politicians that the lockdowns are necessary. They run the daily death toll. Well, here's how many people are infected. Here's how many people died. Oh my gosh, it's a 12% death rate. Oh, it's horrifying. So these cowardly politicians, they get in line. They get in lockstep. That's right. The certain deaths of millions of people, the collapse of the healthcare system, and you'll lose the next election if you let that happen, Mr. Governor, Mr. City Councilman, Mr. Mayor. And so all the politicians get in line and they lock their neighbors in their houses because they're afraid of losing an election. They have no sincere concern for life. I'm sorry. I know I didn't put that well a few weeks ago when I brought up Mr. Cuomo. I should have said he has no sincere concern about tens of thousands of people dying. No sincere concern. Mario Cuomo administers the death of tens of thousands of people every year through his administration of legalized child killing just in the state of New York. So forgive me if I don't believe he has any sincere concern about hundreds or thousands or millions of people dying. And neither do any of these cowardly politicians. What they are concerned about is losing an election. So they convince the politicians to lock us down. And now the media is in the midst of convincing these same cowardly politicians that reopening means certain death. Certain death, another spike, a second wave. And you'll lose the election if you're perceived as the person who opened too early, Mr. Governor, Mr. Mayor, Mr. City Council, Mr. County Supervisor. You don't want to lose that election, do you? But the people are demanding to reopen. So, upon reopening, as it has started now, upon reopening, the media will now start counting the bodies and blaming the politicians that they want out. That's what they're going to do. They're going to blame the politicians that they don't like because the politicians with the nerve to actually start opening their states are generally politicians they don't like. I'm talking about the leftist media. They don't like. So they start counting the bodies, blame the politicians they want out, and then they're hoping to provoke further lockdowns by scared politicians in hopes that they can get all of us locked down again by September, October. That's if we ever get out of the house right now. If they can get everyone else locked down by early September, October, and there's a bloody body count to be held over the head of every politician they don't like, then they hope by Election Day to get enough tragedy ginned up to damage their political opponents enough so that an election that they were surely going to be pummeled, that maybe they'll be able to win. That's what I see happening. And I think it's one of the most vicious political plays ever. To basically imply that if you want people to work and live, that you are killing them. But we'll see. Hopefully I'm way too pessimistic. Hopefully I'm just way too pessimistic and things will go much better than that. I really hope so. I really hope I turn out to be too pessimistic. Meanwhile, more from the Proof of Life file. Nearly 3,300 inmates tested positive for the coronavirus across four state prison systems, with nearly all of them showing no symptoms. 96% of the inmates tested were asymptomatic. So a lot of us get this and we don't even know it. So it's a lot like a lot of other bugs out there. And a lot of other bugs out there, we can get it, we don't know it, we give it to someone else, we didn't even know it, and it could kill them. And it does kill them. Because even before coronavirus came along, people got sick and died. I remember. I was there. Anyway, we have a severe undercount of cases in the U.S., says Dr. Leanna Wen, professor of emergency medicine at George Washington University. She says the case count is likely much, much higher than we currently know. And then she reminds us of the Stanford research that estimated coronavirus is 50 to 85 times more prevalent than previously thought. And new results coming out of France, 25% of students and staff at one high school possessed antibodies. That high school had 9 hospitalizations, but 0 deaths. Anyway, so this is just proof that we are going to be okay. This is not an end-of-the-world type pandemic. It's a nasty bug. And people are going to get sick. Yes. People are going to die. Yes. Is that sad? Yes. But living life has always been thus. We all live life in the shadow of death. You can't get so scared that you lock your neighbors in their houses. That's not right. It's not right. It's not right-headed. It's panic thinking. And I'm just, listen, folks, anyone who thinks that handing the liberty of his neighbor over to criminally insane people in order to preserve life is mistaken. I'm sorry, you are mistaken. You're not allowed to lock your neighbors in their house so that you can preserve life, especially when it's becoming more and more obvious that all of this mitigation is now counterproductive. It's time to get on with tribal immunity. Yes, I've abandoned the term herd immunity because I don't like it, because it makes us sound like animals. I prefer tribal immunity. If the whole tribe becomes immune, it becomes much more difficult for this virus to inflict and kill the people who are at risk. And the faster we get there, the better at this point. People talk about, well, we want to save the maximum amount of lives, says all the pro-aborts that I talk to on Facebook. We want to save maximum life. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, if you really want to save maximum life, we need to get to herd immunity. We need to get that tribal immunity as soon as possible. That saves the maximum amount of life over the long run, because we can actually burn the virus out the way it's always been done. But anyway, none of us have the right to lock our neighbors in their houses and hand over their liberty to obviously criminally insane people. And I'm talking about the government. And folks, when I say criminally insane, that we're being governed by the criminally insane, that's not just an oratorical device that I used for shock value. I actually believe that the governing officials of every city, every state, and of the nation are all criminally insane. And we've basically handed our liberty over to them. We've handed the country over to them because we're scared of getting sick and dying. And I don't know how we stop it. I don't know how we get it back. I don't know if we ever get it back. So I guess we can move on. We've got one here from the What Were We Thinking file. And this is what gets me, and what is frustrating for me, is that when the lockdown first occurred, which mid to late March, I forget exactly. The days all blend together as one long Saturday. But I thought, in a couple weeks we're gonna wake up and like slap ourselves and wonder what have we done. And now we're 6 weeks or more out from that. 6 weeks or more. It's just amazing that this has gone on as long as it's gone on. But I don't know. Fear is a much greater motivator than I could have ever known. I don't know. I don't think I've ever been so scared that I would consider nailing my neighbor's door shut and locking them in the house because I think they might infect me or one of my family members. I never recall being that scared. But anyway, from the What Were We Thinking file, the Daily Wire reports hospitals get paid more money if a patient is coded for the novel coronavirus, even if they haven't been tested in some states. Hospitals get, if you have a COVID admission, Medicare pays $13,000. If that patient goes on a ventilator, you get $39,000. And the author of this commentary is a doctor. And he says, nobody can tell me after 35 years in the world of medicine that sometimes those kinds of things have an impact on what we do. Some physicians really have a bent towards public health, and they'll put down influenza or whatever because that's their preference. This, he says, I myself as a doctor try to stay very specific, very precise. If I know I've got pneumonia, that's what's going on the death certificate. If not, no, I'm not just going to add stuff because it's convenient. But he says not all doctors are like that. In fact, human nature tells us that when at the intersection of health and money, money's a pretty significant concern, especially when the hospitals can't do any elective surgeries and they're all going broke. It's as if through incompetence and inept policy decisions, the government has created a system to gin up more corona deaths than there actually are. And how big could the mistake be? Well, they've made some pretty enormous ones so far. I mean, the 50 to 80% error in the estimates of the fatality rate for the virus. I mean, is it possible that the body count could be 50 to 80 times higher? I doubt it could be that bad, but I'm not going to put it past them. Anyway, the doctor concludes, how can anyone not believe that increasing the number of COVID-19 deaths may create an avenue for states to receive a larger portion of federal dollars? Well, of course we would assume that. And is that a conspiracy theory to assume that? That's not a conspiracy theory. That's just obvious observation of traditional human action. And I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Thanks for sticking with us, folks. We are going into the Dim New World file once again, where the Washington Examiner reports that nursing homes and other long-term care facilities account for a major share of COVID-19 deaths. Yes. A tragedy that appears to be attributable to the vulnerability of that population, poor conditions at the facilities, and a series of policy failures. They go on to talk about the six states that have the highest number of coronavirus deaths, and 40 to 60% of the coronavirus deaths in those states occurred in nursing homes. 14,000 residents and employees at such facilities have so far died with COVID-19, nearly one quarter of the total deaths with the virus. A New York Post investigation found that the New York Department of Public Health denied a request from Cobble Hill Health Center to send coronavirus virus patients to the field hospital at the Javits Center or to the Naval Hospital Ship Comfort. New York State said no. And 55 residents at Cobble Hill have died so far with the coronavirus. Well, the takeaway, don't put your parents in a nursing home. It's just, I didn't put a caveat, if at all possible. I just don't do it. I mean, please, don't put your parents in a home. It's just horrible. I mean, let them move into your basement or something. But I mean, putting your mom in a nursing home is akin to a death sentence. Maybe not that day, maybe not from coronavirus, but it's akin to a death sentence. So just don't do it. All right. It's like with the public schools. I don't say if at all possible, don't send your kids to the public schools. I just say don't send your kids to the public schools. All right. More from the What Were We Thinking file. From Jewish World Review, coronavirus lockdowns have suspended elective surgeries and generally discouraged people from going to the hospital because everyone's terrified. And of course, they're obeying the stay-at-home orders. So many hospitals are getting near or over the financial edge. We all feared that hospitals would get overwhelmed. But what's happened is they've been emptied out. We thought medical personnel would be at a premium. They're being laid off and idled all over the country. This epidemic, in part because of the choices of policymakers, has created a surfeit of hospital beds and an excess of doctors and nurses. We've ended up crowding out many people needing care as a deliberate choice, even where COVID-19 surges haven't happened and probably never will. It's understandable that we wanted hospitals to prepare for the worst. But this is a case where the cure may really have been worse than the disease, or at least has created its own crisis. State edicts can't be loosened up fast enough. In retrospect, they fail the cardinal rule of healthcare. First, do no harm. So, folks, if we can't convince the people who are still scared that it's time that this ends, I mean, we could end up collapsing the healthcare system just out of fear and panic. And so, you know, it's going to be very difficult for politicians, celebrities, media types to admit that this was an overreaction and that they participated. It's going to be very difficult for them. So I just want to offer right now to let you all off the hook. I'm not going to publicly chastise you for having flipped out and freaked out and broken the world. But could you just stop it? Just stop it, okay? All right. What were we thinking, indeed? More from the widespread panic file. John Tyson, the chairman of Tyson Foods, posted up an ad in major newspapers, and he talked about pork and beef and chicken plants that are being forced to close. Millions of pounds of meat's going to disappear from the supply chain. There's going to be limited supply of meat products available in grocery stores until they're able to open their facilities that are currently closed. And there's a combination of factors here. Number one, the stay-at-home order is, it's being taken advantage of by a lot of line workers because they hate their jobs already. And if they can find a way to get on unemployment and not work, and of course with what the Congress put into the all the pork the Congress put into that bill, the $400 a month for 4 months, no, $400 a week, $400 extra a week, so a lot of workers just don't want to go to work. And then of course the government has ordered these places closed by ordering all their workers to stay home. Well, now millions of animals, along with all of the crops we told you about in the over the past few weeks, are going to be depopulated. They're going to be euthanized. They're going to be plowed under. And they're not going to be sold. He says the industry is faced with an impossible choice. Continue to operate to sustain our nation's food supply or shutter to entirely insulate our employees from the risk of this virus. Beyond the implications to our food supply, our entire agricultural community is in jeopardy. And that is a fact. Now, here we go. Donald Trump, though. Trump to the rescue. Right? From the widespread hubris file, Donald Trump signed an executive order last Tuesday to ensure that meat processing plants stay open. Okay. So does Donald Trump think that he can order the creation of meat to occur? Can Donald Trump and the government provide a market for all this meat that's about to have to be euthanized and thrown away? No, he can't. He can order the factories to stay open. Can he make all the workers go back who are so terrified that they're going to get sick and die? No, he can't. Mr. President, we can make hospitals out of convention centers. We've proven that. We cannot make food out of excess ventilators. I'm sorry. You can issue all the orders you want. It doesn't matter. You've got to open everything, and you've got to open it back to normal levels as soon as possible. Speaking of as soon as possible, we go to the politics file, where CNN is reporting that the U.S. may have to endure stay-at-home orders and school closures until 2022. 2022, that's almost 2 years from now. Unless a vaccine or better therapeutics become available, it ain't gonna be like this forever! This is all according to research from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Those findings directly contradict research being touted by the White House, which is why CNN ran this story. the White House, I believe, although I haven't watched the daily rah-rah, whatever it is, because I can't stand the Professor Birkenstock and Dr. Faulty there. I just can't take it. But apparently they have at least acknowledged the antibody testing that shows that the hysterical hyperventilations early on were unjust. Here's the thing, folks. There was a time when it seemed like this could get really bad. And we decided to break the whole world because it seemed like it might get really bad. It looked like it could. It was possible. I don't know. I just can't imagine that I would break the world without knowing that I was that was like the last resort. Anyway, okay, but I'll move on. Harvard's team also projects. Let's see. They say projections also indicate that the virus will come roaring back once restrictions are lifted. It's already roaring, you idiots. It's roaring through all of your social distancing and the grocery stores and the hardware stores and the vector points you left open, big enough to drive a pandemic through, you idiots, with all your virtue signaling and power grabbing. Get off my show. All right. No, I will quote Dr. Mark Lipsitch, one of the authors of this alleged study, and an epidemiology professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, says it may be necessary to do this for several years, which is obviously a very long time. Said the professor. He's no dummy. He realizes that locking people in their house for 2 years is obviously, it's a very long time. And that's it. He doesn't go on to say, well, we realize that this is ludicrous. This is just an academic exercise. No, he presents the paper as this is a policy that should be seriously considered. There's also difficult social questions around immunity certificates. Oh, here we go with the immunity certificates and the contact tracing. These people are out of their minds. All right. And by the way, I just heard that the governor of Oregon has extended the lockdown in Oregon through July 6th. I said July 6th. That's over 2 months from now. Okay. Can I just, make a prediction, that's not going to happen. People in Oregon are not, and if there were any ever people who could just stay in their house for 2 months because it was just raining outside, it would be the people in Oregon. But the people in Oregon are not going to stay in their houses for 2 months. There's not enough flannel and marijuana to keep them happy. They're going to have to leave their houses. All right. More from the Weatherman file. The World Health Organization, one of the top officials there, Dr. Mike Ryan, is now applauding Sweden for its approach to the coronavirus outbreak, an approach that did not include lockdown. Mr. Ryan, who I'm sure is a socialist left-wing maniac, I mean, he's at the World Health Organization. But he says, quote, I think if we are to reach a new normal, I think in many ways Sweden presents a future model of a society in which we don't have lockdowns. Okay. All right. So anyway, the thing about Sweden is they were already so thoroughly feminized and socialized that the government didn't have to lock them down. They're a fairly, they pretty much don't ever touch each other already. And they're already thoroughly socialist. They're already thoroughly feminized. And so there's very little need to lock them in their houses. Anyway, Sweden did it through suggestions and advice, and they encouraged people to wash their hands, keep their distance, stay home if you're sick, if you're old and vulnerable, only go out if you have to, try to get your family to bring you food. And there are some estimates that Sweden will achieve tribal immunity within the next few weeks. What else does Mr. Mike Ryan, the weatherman? What do you mean, what did I say last week? Huh? What are you talking about? Did I say rain? Really? I don't recall that. Let's just move on. Sweden's healthcare system has always remained within its capacity to respond to the number of cases that they've been experiencing. Did you folks get that? I said early on, we're going to be able to watch Sweden, and the data will not lie. And so Sweden's death rate right now looks a little higher than some of its neighbors. But when we look at this in the long game, the long game is going to show who did the right thing and who did not. And I predict that Sweden's overall death rate over the long term will be lower than its neighbors who prolonged this by locking everyone in their houses, which was foolish. Meanwhile, from the idiot file, Donald Trump ripped Sweden on Thursday for not locking down.
What?
Yeah, that's right. This is the day before. Let's see. This is from, I don't have the actual dates here, but I believe this is the day before the WHO official, Mike Ryan, came out and applauded Sweden. The day before that, Donald Trump went on Twitter and tweeted that, despite reports to the contrary, let's see, can I do a Donald Trump impression?
No.
I shouldn't even try?
No.
All right, I won't even try. My extremely attractive audio engineer knows when to pull on the reins. Anyway, Trump tweeted, despite reports to the contrary, Sweden is paying heavily for its decision not to lock down. As of today, 2,462 people have died there, a much higher number than the neighboring countries of Norway, Finland, and Denmark. Blah, 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 blah. The United States made the correct decision. Uh-huh. Well, that's you only say that, Mr. Trump, because that's the decision you supported. And it's going to be very difficult to get any of these people to admit that it was the wrong thing to do.
Because he did that they said it. That's right.
What's that?
Because he said that they decided to.
Oh, yeah, and that might be it. That might maybe because No, I think Trump's tweet came out the day after, although I'm not sure. We'll have to check the timing on this. It could be that because the WHO said something nice. No, because Trump said something mean about Sweden, the WHO felt compelled to say something nice. It could be. That could be. We'll have to check the timing on those. And then we'll now, from the widespread tyranny file, a file that gets bigger and bigger every week, a Harvard Law School professor, Elizabeth Bartholet, has published a paper, and in that paper, she cites a paper published last year from the Arizona Law Review, basically describing homeschooling as authoritarian. She says, homeschooling is a realm of near absolute parental power, inconsistent with rights and guaranteed to children under the state constitutions. Yes, yes, yes. She's basically implying that she believes that the Constitution and legislation can supplant parental authority, and she is incorrect on that. Now, it can be used as a weapon against parents. There's no doubt about that, unjustly. But constitutions and legislation cannot actually supplant parental authority, but she doesn't believe in parental authority because she doesn't believe in God. She doesn't believe in the family unit that God created as the foundation of all society. No, she believes, quote, states should impose significant restrictions. Significant. Along the lines described below. And then as it goes on, she says, some homeschooling parents are extreme religious ideologues who live in near total isolation and hold views in serious conflict with those generally deemed central to our society. That describes us to a T. Look at that. Well, hey, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And she nailed it there. Yeah, huh? Uh-huh. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that wasn't her. She was quoting a Columbia University, Michael Rebell. So there we go. Many homeschooling parents belong to fundamentalist religious groups. Wow. They believe that exposing their children to ideas such as secularism, atheism, feminism, and value relativism is inconsistent with the values they espouse. Well, he's got me nailed. That's for sure. Both of us. He goes on. I don't know if this is so. This is Bartholet, the Harvard professor, goes on to say, do we think that parents should have 24/7 essentially authoritarian control over their children from ages 0 to 18? I think that's dangerous. Well, Ms. Bartholet, that's because if the parent were you, it would be dangerous. So a little bit of projection going on. She says it's always dangerous to put powerful people in charge of the powerless.
Huh.
What does that mean?
It's governors.
Yeah, by the way, by definition, people in power are powerful people. You can't have people in power not being more powerful than the people they're exerting power over. But to assume that we're all powerless is a bit much. Anyway, so there's Harvard at reason number 1211 to get or keep your children out of any government-funded schools. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson and his girlfriend, Carrie, have announced the birth of an illegitimate son. That's right. They announced in March that they had become engaged and were expecting a baby in early summer. And it seems that the young man has come along a little earlier than possible, but everyone, according to the prime minister and the slut that he's sleeping with at the moment, they say the mother and baby are doing well. Everybody's doing well. And I'm not sure if they've announced a date for the big wedding yet, but we're all waiting on the edge of our seats. Meanwhile, the Dim New World File brings us another story. The marriage rate in the United States has fallen now to a record low, the lowest figure since 1867, after the Civil War had ravaged the United States for 4.5 years. But there's no civil war. There's no real reason for this except for atheism, video games, marijuana, and pornography. That's it. Okay. The marriage rate just in 2018 plummeted 6%. Millennials are in peak marriage years in their 20s and 30s, but the rate of marriage continues to fall across the country. Let's see. I think that's all. I've got a few more stories here on the whole lockdown and people who are beginning to resist and all of that. Here. I want to close with this because I saw this and I'm going to post this up because I want you people to see this video, okay? A 93-year-old couple sitting on folding chairs that they had brought to a beach in Oxnard out in California. Well, they're sitting there on the beach when a policeman approached, asked them to get off their chairs and sit on the ground if they wanted to remain where they were. They did not understand why they could sit on the beach but not on chairs. So the policeman reasoned with them that his reasoning was that the folding chairs indicated that the couple were creating a permanent place as opposed to the temporary nature of sitting on the sand itself. Okay. So we have definitely entered the Twilight Zone, and I want you all to see this video because the people who are filming it are telling the cops, they're like, hey, they're old people, leave them alone. But nope, the bureaucratic police officer goes, anyway, it's just embarrassing, I'll post it up, watch the video. That's it for the Weekly Worldview this week, folks. Thank you for tuning in. I want to thank my friends at realscienceradio.com, and of course at American Right to Life and my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen. Here in the Weekly Worldview Studios, should the Lord tarry, we will return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.